Afi said bitterly, as she and Amari sat quietly on the deck watching the activity.
"What will happen when we arrive in their land?"
Amari asked.
"We will be sold once more, perhaps many times."
"We no longer belong to ourselves, Amari."
"What do you think it is like there?"
"The same sun shines upon their land. The moon and the stars glow each night. Trees grow green and tall in the sunlight. But I have a feeling it will be as different from our land as life is from death."
"I'm afraid, Afi,"
Amari admitted.
"So am I, child. So am I."
Amari had very little time to worry about the future, however, for she heard Bill, the red-headed sailor, who was working on the tallest sail of the ship, suddenly shout,
"Land ho!"
She wasn't sure what the words meant, but by the loud, boisterous reaction of the sailors, who whooped in celebration, she knew it could mean only one thing. This part of their journey was almost over. Amari could see seabirds flying overhead, and as she looked with the rest of the women at the faint hint of green in the distance, she did not share in the joy of the sailors, however. Amari was overcome by fear. Chapter 12. Welcome to Sullivan's Island.
Kaboom!
The ship's cannon fired suddenly, sending the slave women on deck scurrying for cover. Amari cowered close to Afi, sure that her life was about to end. The sailors, however, seemed unconcerned, even cheerful, as they steered the ship toward its destination. Some of them whistled, a sound that Amari found to be particularly distasteful. She peeked over the edge of the ship, and suddenly, green and golden beyond the blue of the sea, the land appeared from the distant mists. Amari had no idea what to imagine, but the land she saw was surprisingly beautiful, with lush green trees growing quite close to a long sandy beach.
"Afi," she whispered, "the land is lovely. I thought it must surely be an ugly place."
"Yes, it is beautiful to look at. Remember that when the ugliness overtakes you," Afi told her.
"Find beauty wherever you can, child. It will keep you alive."
"I could not have survived without you, Afi," Amari told her, giving the older woman a clumsy hug.
"And you have been a gift to me as well, Amari. I'm glad we were together for this horrible journey."
"What happens now?" Amari asked.
Afi had no time to answer, for a small boat came up close to the ship, and a balding white man climbed on board. He wore a cloth tied across his face. The captain of their ship laughed and welcomed him aboard. The first thing Amari noticed was that the newcomer was clean, smelling strongly of the scent of too many flowers. He coughed and choked, as if the very air of the slave ship would infect him with illness. It was clear he was reacting to a terrible odor. Amari could make out only a few of the words between them. She could figure out the words stink and slave and cargo, and that the man who had come on board was some sort of official from the land they were heading toward. Amari realized, as she listened intently to their conversation, that she and her fellow slaves were the cargo. Then she saw the captain hand something to the man. It was a small leather pouch that bulged with silver objects. The man took it greedily and stuffed it into his shirt. The captain then laughed again and pointed to Afi and Amari and the other women on the deck. The man walked over to the slave women and rubbed his hands together. With a look that seemed to Amari to combine disgust as well as desire, he proceeded to examine each of the women slaves very carefully. Afi was called first. Like the rest of the women, she was just about naked.
He checked every bone and muscle of her body by running his hands over her, noting flaws or bruises. Afi's back showed many scars, and he frowned with displeasure. He looked inside her mouth and checked her teeth. He checked her genitals. She kept her eyes closed. Amari knew that Afi's mind was in another place.
"Good breeder,"
she heard the man say, as he smacked Afi on the buttocks. Amari did not know what that meant. Afi was sent back to her place on the deck, and Amari was called next. Using Afi's strength as an example, Amari stood quietly as she was touched and examined and fondled. Her impulse was to jerk away from him, but she forced herself to stand silently. The rest of the women were checked next. Then the men, who had been brought up on deck, were examined as well. The man scribbled some marks on a flat sheet he carried and gave it to the captain. Amari listened carefully to his words, and even though she did not fully understand their meaning, she knew that her life was about to change again.
"Your cargo is approved to land, Captain. Welcome to Sullivan's Island."
Chapter 13. The Slave Auction. The next day, the slaves were taken in groups from the ship. The women were placed in small boats, similar to the ones that had taken them away from their homeland. Fewer boats were needed to unload the surviving slaves than when they had started out. As he helped her from the ship into one of the small boats, Bill refused to look at Amari directly. He mumbled into her ear,
"Be brave, child. God have mercy on you."
Amari glanced back to see him, but he was gone. The rowers were swift, and the journey was short. It took only a few minutes to reach the beach on the place they called Sullivan's Island. Chained and pushed, Amari was unloaded with the others. She tried to walk, but she kept falling onto the sand. Her legs felt like they were made of mashed fufu. She glanced around and saw that most of the slaves, and some of the sailors as well, had difficulty adjusting to land after such a long time journeying on the ocean. A long, well-trodden path lay in front of them. Tall grasses grew in abundance on either side of it. Three solemn seabirds flew overhead. All was unusually silent. When most of the slaves were able to walk, they were led to a large building about a half mile from the beach. It was made of wood and stone, a smaller version of the prison at Cape Coast. None of their captors spoke to them, except to yell or curse, nor did they try to explain what was happening. Talk surrounded them, however, as one slave was pointed to with great interest, or another was laughed at. The slaves were fed, given water, and even supplied with extra water in small basins with which to bathe. Their wounds were patched or covered, and they were oiled and prepared for whatever was to come next. The whole area was full of nervous tension. A tall black man entered the room. He limped noticeably, and he was dressed in a ragged version of the clothing of the whites. He looked at them, shook his head sadly, then addressed the slaves in the white language, seemingly giving instructions. They gazed at him blankly. Finally, as soon as all of the white men had stepped outside of the building, the black man switched to the Ashanti language, speaking quickly and softly.
"Listen, my brothers. I know not all of you can understand me, but I can see that some of you are Ashanti and Ewe. I will be whipped if they catch me talking African, as they call it. But I must tell you some things. You must learn their language quickly. It is called English. But try not to forget your own. Submit and obey if you want to live. You are at a place called Sullivan's Island, where you will be kept for 10 days, until they are sure you have no disease. Smallpox is the worst. Then you will be taken to a place called Charles Town,
where you will be sold to the highest bidder." A white soldier re-entered the building, and the black man smoothly switched back to the language of the whites. The black man, whom the soldiers called Tybee, passed out some rough garments for them to wear. A simple smock for the women, a shirt and trousers for the men. He told them the names of each item in English as he gave it to them. Shirt. Shift. Apron. Then pointed out other words they would need, like massa, yes'm, and yessa. Amari was surprised and pleased that she was able to understand quite a few of the words he said. They stayed there on the island for several days, waiting for the unknown. During the day, the slaves were fed and their wounds were treated. But at night, fear was the blanket that covered each of them. Amari lay on the ground one particularly hot night, trying to escape into sleep. She curled herself into a ball, but as soon as she closed her eyes, memories assaulted her. So she sat back up, leaning against the rough wooden wall. She looked over and was surprised to see Besa, who had worked his way as close to her as he could in spite of his chains. She quickly lowered her head. "My lovely Amari," he greeted her quietly in their language, as if hope still shone in their sky. "How goes your day?"
"Better, now that you are here," she said, remembering sadly that day that seemed so long ago. "But I am no longer lovely, and my days will never be happy again."
She tried not to cry.
"When you look at the sun and the stars," he whispered, "I want you to remember me and smile. I want you to know that you will always be my lovely Amari."
One of the guards noticed them talking then and slashed at Besa with his whip. Besa glared at him, but he understood the danger of retaliation. He allowed himself to be led back to the far side of the men's area, where the guard kicked him fiercely. Amari had to look away. Early the next morning, the slaves were once again shackled and packed into boats, looking healthier and feeling stronger than they had in a very long time. They were ready for sail. The shoreline, Amari noticed, as they were unloaded at the place her captors called Charlestown, was rocky and harsh, rather than soft beach. Amari looked then at an amazing sight. Tall buildings and people seemingly everywhere crowded the area. "What has happened to the trees?" she thought. "And what are all these structures? Surely these white people must have great magic to make such buildings. And there are so many of them." "Afi," Amari whispered, "the faces of brown and black that I see, are they slaves?"
"I cannot tell for sure, but I think so," Afi whispered back. "Most of them do not seem to walk with authority."
"I think we have arrived in a backward world, where black skins are few and not respected, and pale skins seem to rule," Amari commented quietly.
They were taken to a place that Amari heard them call the Custom House. It was a big, drafty building with a large door. Pushed into a small shed next to it, the slaves waited in silence on the dirt floor. The sun rose. The room began to get unbearably hot. The hours passed, and the sun set again. They were given food and water at the end of the day, then locked back in the shed for the night. Amari, hot and sweaty, whispered to Afi,
"What are they waiting for?"
"Buyers," Afi declared.
Amari's stomach clenched with fear. Early the next morning, white men lined up the slaves, sloshed cold water on them, and had other slaves rub oil all over their bodies. The oil stank, and Amari coughed at the odor.
"Now it begins," Afi said sadly.
By the time the sun had begun to shine brightly, the sail had started. Besa and a coffle of men were taken as the first to be auctioned off. As he and the others were led from the holding area, a great cry of enthusiasm could be heard from the crowd outside. Amari could hear loud, excited words tossed back and forth, much like the tones of bargaining her mother had used on market days. She heard someone say the word, "Sold!" And she knew she would never see Besa again. The rest of the men, some in sets of two or three, some singly, were sold as the morning went on. By midday, it was time for the women. In spite of the heat, Amari trembled. She gazed out of the shed's single window at the sun, which glistened bright and harsh. No warmth, no soft shadows to hide her embarrassment, no hope. She wondered how the sun could shine so brightly on this land of evil people. Nothing made sense to her any longer. Not days or nights, not past or present. This was the summer of her 15th year, and this day she wanted to die. More buyers had arrived. Afi and Amari and the other women were stripped naked. Amari bit her lip, determined not to cry. But she couldn't stop herself from screaming out as her arms were wrenched behind her back and tied. A searing pain shot up through her shoulders. A white man clamped shackles on her ankles, rubbing his hands up and down her legs as he did. Amari tensed and tried to jerk away, but the chains were too tight. She could not hold back the tears. Amari shuffled in the dirt as she was led into the yard and up onto a raised wooden table, which she realized gave the people in the yard a perfect view of the women who were to be sold. She looked at the faces in the sea of pink-skinned people who stood around pointing at the captives and jabbering in their language as each of the slaves was described. She looked for pity or even understanding, but found nothing except cool stares. They looked at her as if she were a cow for sale. She saw a few white women fanning themselves and whispering in the ears of well-dressed men. Their husbands, she supposed. Most of the people in the crowd were men. However, she did see a poorly dressed white girl about her own age standing near a wagon. The girl had a sullen look on her face, and she seemed to be the only person not interested in what was going on at the slave sale. Amari looked up at a seabird flying above and remembered her little brother. "I wish he could have flown that night," Amari thought sadly. "I wish I could have flown away as well." Part 2. Polly. Chapter 14. The Slave Sale. Polly really didn't like Negroes. As far as she was concerned, they should all get shipped back to Africa or wherever it was they came from. They talked funny. They smelled bad. And they were ugly. How could the good Lord have made such creatures? Polly wondered, as she glanced with boredom at the slave sale. Dark skin, big lips, and hair the texture of a briar bush. They were just plain unpleasant to deal with. Besides, Negroes made it difficult for regular folks like herself to get work. Who could compete with somebody who worked for free? She scratched an insect bite on her arm, unrolled a sheaf of paper, and leaned against the wooden wagon of Mr. Percival Derby, owner of Derbyshire Farms. Proud of the fact that she could read, Polly looked over her certificate of indenture one more time. She mumbled and moved her lips as she read. "His Majesty King George II, in the year of our Lord 1738, on this, the second day of June, in the city of Charlestown, colony of South Carolina, hereby sets the indenture of one Polly Elizabeth Pritchard, age 15 years, to Mr. Percival Derby, for a period not to exceed 14
14 years.
Polly frowned. She'd not been able to shorten the 14-year term. A normal indenture was 7 years, but she had to pay off the debts of her parents, and the only way she was allowed to do that was to sign up for a double indenture. She'd have to work for Mr. Derby until she was an old woman, almost 29, but she was determined that long before that time, she would have figured out a way to get out of the contract. She looked back at the slave sale. The women were wailing and acting as if something terrible was happening to them. Polly snorted and turned away. Living here in the colonies had to be better than living like a savage in the jungle. They ought to be grateful, she thought. She thought of the Negroes she'd known as a child, well-fed and happy slaves, with no worries about finding employment. No, she had no sympathy. The sail was getting boisterous. Polly looked up.
"Fresh from Africa,"
the auctioneer told the crowd.
"Mold 'em into what you want 'em to be. Look at 'em, all of them healthy and ready for childbearing. Come on up and take a look. Feel free to inspect the merchandise."
An unbelievably large white man who smelled of strong wine and an even stronger body odor waddled past Polly and up to the auction area. She covered her nose and laughed behind her hand. He seemed to have difficulty breathing. He climbed onto the riser where the Negro women stood and headed directly to the youngest one there, a girl about her own age. He opened the girl's mouth and put his fingers inside. Polly grimaced, not because she felt sorry for the girl, but because the man was so repulsive. Then the fat man touched the girl's breasts and ran his hands down her legs.
"Nice," Polly heard him rasp. "I'll give £10 for the girl,"
he said to the auctioneer, wheezing between his words. He ignored the woman standing next to the girl.
"Do I hear more than £10 for this fine example of African womanhood? Hardly a scratch on her. Bright enough to be taught simple commands like, come here and lie down."
The crowd laughed at that, but Polly didn't.
£20, called a voice from the back of the crowd.
The fat man looked up in astonishment.
£30,
he responded loudly. He sat down on the edge of the wooden platform and pulled out a filthy handkerchief. He wiped his face, which was sweating profusely.
£40, called the voice from the back again.
People turned to see who was outbidding the large man in the front.
"She's not worth 45,
the big man yelled to the crowd.
"Is that your bid?"
the auctioneer asked. The fat man hesitated.
"Yes," he said then. "I want her." "I hear 45, do I hear 50?
The crowd waited in anticipation.
£60 for the African girl, the voice cried out at last. "I want her for my son. Today is his 16th birthday."
The crowd cheered. No one seemed to want the large man to win this one. The auctioneer looked at the large man, who was still wiping his brow.
"He can have her," the big man said finally. "I'll give me a young gal another day." "Sold," the auctioneer said loudly, "for £60 to Mr. Percival Derby of Derbyshire Farms."
Polly looked up with surprise. She hadn't known who was doing the bidding. Then she shrugged. She just hoped Mr. Derby's new purchase would get put out in the fields where she belonged.
"Will you be wanting her mama, sir?"
the auctioneer said to Mr. Derby. "I'll offer her to you first, out of respect, you see." Polly watched as Mr. Derby, who had walked up to the stage to claim his property, glanced at the older woman standing next to the slave girl, then said,
"No, Horace, but thanks for the offer. Family ties only confuse the poor creatures. They'll forget each other as soon as the sun sets, trust me."
Mr. Derby grabbed the arm of his new slave and attempted to lead her off the stage. But for some reason, she just went wild. Polly watched, fascinated,
as the girl squirmed and screeched and babbled incoherently. Polly wondered if Negroes from Africa had feelings and intelligent thoughts, or if that gibberish they spoke was more like the screaming of monkeys or the barking of dogs. When she was 5 or 6 years old, back in Beaufort where she'd been born, she played with Negro children sometimes, running through the tobacco fields playing hide-and-seek. But her father had frowned on such, and would call Polly inside their small house. He'd say, "The company you keep will rub off on you, Polly girl. Don't get your hands dirty by dealing with darkies." Her mother would shake her head at her husband, then pull Polly close to her. "I want you to grow up to be a fine lady, my pretty Polly. I don't want you to have to do laundry like I do. So let the slave children tend to their work in the field, and I will read to you from the Bible." Polly would snuggle on her mother's lap and fall asleep listening to the rhythm of her voice as she read. Turning her attention back to the sale, Polly realized that the girl they were dragging off the auction block now was weeping real tears and seemed to be genuinely attached to that older female African whose shackled hand she wouldn't let go of. Mr. Derby slapped the girl across the face, but she continued to pull and buck on the chains. She lurched toward the woman, but her leg chains got twisted, and she stumbled. She fell hard, landing at the woman's chained feet. The older woman, who was also crying, leaned down and quickly whispered something in the girl's ear. The girl was then pulled with difficulty from the stage, dragged across the dirt courtyard, and forced into the back of the wagon that Polly leaned on. The people in the crowd cheered at the spectacle, but Mr. Derby did not seem to be amused. He glared at Polly, who stepped quickly out of his way. He turned on his heel then, and went to pay for his purchase. Polly watched him coolly as he strode away, his shiny black boots getting dusty as he walked. She knew he wouldn't leave right away. His son, who he had sent to pick up supplies from the wharf, had not yet returned. The bidding continued as the last of the women were sold. It seemed to Polly that the slave girl curled in the corner of the wagon would never stop crying. Chapter 15. Polly and Clay. Polly, with hair the color of dried grass and eyes the color of a stormy sky, understood tears. She also knew that tears fixed nothing. As far as she was concerned, crying showed weakness and was simply a waste of time. Tears had not kept her father out of prison, nor had crying made a difference when he died of smallpox. She'd wept bitterly when her mother had died of the disease as well. But not one tear had given her a bite to eat or a place to stay. So she did her best to ignore the slave girl who hiccuped and shook with sobs. Mr. Derby's son, presumably the young man with the birthday and the tearful gift in the back of the wagon, arrived then with a smartly dressed black man who struggled under the weight of several bags of supplies. "Hurry up, Noah! Get these loaded!" the boy yelled to the black man. The young Master Derby carried a small whip, and he used it liberally to make Noah work faster. Polly noticed that the slave breathed slowly and loudly, as if he were tense, but he made no attempt to stop the young man from hitting him. She was always amazed at how much abuse slaves took without it seeming to bother them. Perhaps they didn't feel the pain the way others did. She wasn't sure. "Yassa, massa." Noah, dressed in clothing almost as elegant as a white slave owner's, bowed, then continued to load the wagon. "Do you dress all your slaves as fine as King George?" Polly asked. Clay turned slowly. "How dare you speak to me?" he responded furiously. "If you're the gal whose indenture my father just bought, you best learn your place around here." Unintimidated, Polly gazed directly into his angry gray eyes and replied, "The slave owners I've encountered seem to clothe their slaves in just enough to allow for decency. Certainly never in finery. Do you dress them all like that one?" Clay burst into laughter.
They could all run around naked as far as I'm concerned. But when Daddy comes to market, he likes to arrive with his driver dressed with style, he explained.
So why do you hit him?
Polly asked. She didn't like Negroes particularly, but she saw no reason why they should always be beaten.
They expect to be disciplined, Clay explained. It shows them that I care enough to make sure they do their tasks correctly. That's what my father always taught me. And what business is it of yours anyway?
Just curious.
Curiosity can get a gal like you in a heap of trouble. You best learn to keep your mouth shut, Clay warned.
I've seen a heap of trouble, Polly replied. I'm not afraid of you.
But her heart fluttered under her smock. Clay raised his arm as if to strike her, then lowered it as the anger on his face eased into a smile.
You're a saucy young thing, he said finally. He spat into the dirt.
Polly just looked at him with a cool stare.
Was that your indenture I saw you looking at? He asked. You can read?
Polly was not sure how to answer him, but she nodded as she quickly folded the paper and tucked it into a pocket of her apron.
Let me warn you, girl. Women don't need to be reading, so just keep that ability to yourself. And don't ever get it in your mind to teach a slave to read. My father would have you whipped for such.
Polly inhaled sharply, but did not answer him. She thought only slaves could be whipped. She noticed that Noah was gently picking up the trembling slave girl, moving her to the other side of the wagon, and placing her on a blanket that lay wrinkled on the rough floorboard. The slave girl never opened her eyes. She just curled herself into a ball and huddled in that corner of the wagon. Clay Derby mirrored his father in looks. Dark, thick eyebrows that left his eyes in shadow. Long fingers and broad shoulders. His father, walking with swift authority, approached the wagon. People moved out of his way as he walked. Clay seemed a little less sure of himself in the presence of his father, Polly thought. He pulled on his doublet, flicked some dirt from his boots, and smoothed his stockings.
Come, Clay said to Polly, taking her arm roughly. I can see that father has paid for my gift and is about ready to go. Whenever you speak to him, be sure to show proper respect. He hates women who don't know their place.
Yes, sir, Polly mumbled sullenly.
Did you enjoy the slave auction?
Mr. Derby asked Polly as he returned to the wagon and began to check on his goods. Evading the question, Polly replied,
It was like nothing I have ever seen, sir.
She looked at the ground.
Speak up, girl, Mr. Derby commanded. Look at me when you address me.
Polly looked up at him, her blue eyes bright with a bit of defiance.
Yes, sir, she said clearly.
Mr. Derby opened his mouth as if to respond, then seemed to think better of it, for he turned to his duties instead. The African girl, her hands tied in front of her with a rope, was still sniffling quietly. She was dressed in a thin shift made of a burlap seed bag. Her slender brown shoulders heaved.
Quit that sniveling!
Mr. Derby yelled at her suddenly. He leaned over the side of the wagon and slapped her sharply across her face. The girl, seemingly surprised, looked up and gulped back her tears. Polly noticed a brief smoldering anger on the girl's face. Then it dissolved into a look of resigned submission.
Noah, hurry and finish loading,
Mr. Derby commanded the slave.
We have a long journey ahead of us.
He did not use the whip as his son had. Noah packed up the rest of the supplies, farm tools, several bags of seed, and some rolls of cloth, and tied them down carefully. There would be barely enough room for Polly to squeeze in.
Polly, you get in back there,
Mr. Derby ordered when Noah finished.
Yes, sir,
Polly muttered as she climbed into the wagon. She sat as far away as she could from the African slave girl, making sure the bundles separated them. The girl had covered her head with her hands.
Polly Pritchard, my indentured girl,
Meet my new little savage. From my inspection of her, I figure the two of you are about the same age.
Mr. Derby choked out a laugh. Polly didn't see what was funny.
And I know you have met my son, Clay,
Mr. Derby said. Mr. Derby looked at his son with pride. But the young man had his dark eyes on the terrified African girl. Mr. Derby climbed onto the seat of the wagon, indicated to Clay to join him, then gave the signal to Noah to begin the journey. Noah made a chucking sound to the horse, and the wagon lurched onto the dirt road. Polly could feel each bump and jolt of the road beneath her as the wooden wheels lurched over each uneven place in the dirt or gouged hole left by other wagons. After one particularly deep dip in the road, Polly was tossed across the bags of seed, landing hard against the slave girl, who opened her eyes and looked around frantically. Polly scrambled quickly back to the other side of the wagon. The two girls eyed each other carefully. Polly had always prided herself on her looks. When she got the chance to glance in a mirror, she was always pleased at the peachy paleness of her face, which bore, thankfully, no scars from smallpox like many women she knew, and the blue-green clarity of her eyes. Unconsciously, she touched her hair, which her mother had loved to brush. It grew thick and straight. She remembered her father used to call it golden flax. She knew the African girl was probably admiring her. Polly looked at the large brown eyes, the short cropped hair, and the ebony-colored skin of the slave and saw nothing worthy of admiration. She sniffed. The girl even smelled bad. The journey seemed to last forever as the wagon rumbled down the road. The sun, wickedly hot, seared Polly's fair skin. She longed for just a dipper of water. Polly turned her attention to Clay. Sitting in a slouch, he kept spitting off the side of the wagon at regular intervals. Mr. Derby sat next to the driver, continually checking his fingernails and picking specks of dirt off his boots. They had been traveling for almost 2 hours when Mr. Derby announced,
"Well, Clay, what shall we call our latest acquisition? Since the new slave is to be yours, I shall let you name her."
Before Clay could speak, however, Polly spoke up quietly. "She probably already has a name, sir." Clay spun around and glared at Polly, as if to remind her of his warning about women staying in their place.
"Nonsense," Mr. Derby replied, irritation in his voice. "Those jungle words have no meaning to civilized humans. I suggest you keep your opinions to yourself."
Polly said nothing more, but she looked long and hard at the slave girl's face. Clay did the same thing. Finally, he said to his father,
"I shall name her Minor, because she is mine."
He cleared his throat and spat once more. Polly thought she had never met anyone with such an enlarged impression of himself. Mr. Derby snorted.
"It will do as well as any other. She is a most excellent birthday present, Father,"
Clay said as he glanced once more at the girl who huddled in the corner. He grinned and rubbed his hands together. Mr. Derby looked at his son indulgently.
"A boy turns 16 only once, so I decided that just as my father provided a slave girl for me when I got old enough, I would do the same for you. I imagine one day you'll do the same for your son," he added.
Polly listened in amazement. She'd had very little experience with wealthy people, but she'd never met anyone with attitudes like the Derby men seemed to have. She glanced at the African girl, who surely had no idea what her future held. She found herself feeling sorry for this new slave who huddled in the wagon, glistening with sweat.
"Black women are different, you know, Clay,"
Mr. Derby continued.
"They like it when you pick them out for special favors at night. It keeps them happy and..."
He paused to flick a speck off his waistcoat.
"It reminds them in a very special way
who is the master and who is the slave.
He took a deep breath of the summer air.
I will take good care of her father, Clay replied, pleasant anticipation in his voice. The wagon suddenly lurched to one side, the horse snorting and neighing as it pulled at the reins. Mr. Derby and Clay were tossed on the wagon seat.
Can't you handle that animal? Clay shouted at Noah.
Yassir,
Noah replied, pulling the animal into a more controlled gait.
Must have been a bug or a skeeter that spooked him, sir.
Polly had a feeling Noah knew exactly what that horse was doing every moment. She also decided she didn't like this young man with the dark eyebrows, the sneering smile, and the repulsive need to spit so often. Clay and his father continued their conversation as if Polly and the slave sitting next to her did not exist.
White women, like my Isabel and your mother before her, ought to be respected and treated like fine china, Mr. Derby told his son. It's not often a man finds true love twice in his lifetime, he said with a lilt in his voice. I wish you'd try harder to warm up to your stepmother, Clay.
You never should have married her, Clay replied sullenly. She's far too young for you, and she wears that vacant smile all the time. She reminds me of a sheep.
He spat off the side of the coach once more, then shifted on his seat.
Why did you decide to purchase the girl's indenture? He asked, glancing back at Polly.
The little white girl comes to us with an indenture as long as my arm. There's no way she can pay it off in less than 14 years. I figure she will be a good investment. She's from Beaufort, south of here. Both her parents are dead.
Clay turned to look at her.
Don't worry, Polly girl. You'll like it at Derbyshire Farms. Lots of sheep, slaves, and chickens. And rice. Lots of work to do.
He gave a small laugh. Polly bristled. Polly Girl had been her father's pet name for her, and it angered her to hear it pour so carelessly from the mouth of this unpleasant young man. A faint breeze moved the hot air as they traveled. No other wagons or people were to be seen. Huge live oak trees lined each side of the road, with dangling beards of Spanish moss hanging from each branch. Polly thought the trees looked like old men bent over and exhausted from the heat. Perhaps they watched over all who lived here, she thought briefly. It had been a long time since someone had cared for her. After the deaths of her parents, she'd lived almost like a prisoner in the rat-infested attic of a dirt farmer named Jeremy Carton. He rarely spoke to her except to give orders. He had a wife and a daughter, both of them thick of mind and body, who'd ignored her as well, except when the pigsty had to be cleaned, or the manure from the horses needed to be collected for fertilizer. Polly longed for a kind word, a loving touch, but she kept a stony distance from everyone. The Carton family never saw her cry, not even when her parents died, never heard a word of complaint from her. She knew they thought her to be cold and unfeeling.
This is going to be my chance to make something of myself, she vowed. I shall not let anything or anyone get in my way. I intend to make myself necessary to the Derby family while learning how the upper class lives.
It pleased her to imagine her grand goals, but she was deadly serious about working her way up to be the fine lady her mother had dreamed she would be. The oppressive heat and constant rhythm of the wagon wheels finally made Polly sleepy, and she dozed uncomfortably for a couple of hours. When she was startled awake by a deep rut in the road, she could see the fiery redness of the sun above the trees in the distance. The wagon pulled into a narrow lane then, and Polly could see the two-story brick manor house ahead. It was almost blindingly white in the late afternoon sun. It looked as if it had been whitewashed several times for the brick to be so completely covered, Polly surmised.
its red gabled roof, nestled between two huge stone chimneys, also carried an aura of perfection. It was surrounded by a carpet of lush grass, kept short, she found out later, by the many sheep that grazed upon it. On her far right were green fields, and behind them dark woods grew full and deep. Far to her left, many black faces labored in a large field near a river. They seemed to be standing in water.
"Welcome to Derbyshire Farms, Miss Polly," Clay said, making a sweeping movement with his arm. "The river you see yonder is the Ashley."
Polly didn't know what to say. Everywhere she glanced, she saw perfection. Not a stone was out of place on the path they drove on. Not a flower in the garden seemed to be wilted. Oh, to own such a glorious property, she thought with an intake of breath. She noticed Mr. Derby looking carefully at his domain, as if checking to make sure everything was as it should be. Several slaves rushed out to meet the wagon. One carried a broom and began sweeping the path behind them. Another carried a tray of cold drinks for Mr. Derby and Clay. No one spoke to the master or his son. Mr. Derby ignored the slaves and ordered Noah to turn to the right. They continued down a rutted lane, then stopped in front of a small shack made of wood. Polly noticed several other similar huts in the area, but she had no time to wonder about them, because just then Mr. Derby ordered them out of the wagon. Polly nodded and climbed stiffly down. She motioned to the African girl to do the same. Mr. Derby pointed to the shack.
"Here is where you will live. This slave is your responsibility for now. I can't spare any field hands to break in a new African, and I certainly won't have anyone of my household doing such a task."
But Polly looked at him with a surprised frown on her face and started to object. Then she suddenly realized with dismay what he meant. She was not going to be installed in his household, where she could observe and absorb fine living, but would be forced to live with this slave girl instead. How humiliating.
"I could be of great help to you, sir, as part of your household staff," she offered.
"This is how you will assist me," Mr. Derby replied, his face showing impatience. "I need for her to act like a human instead of a monkey. Do you think you can tame a savage?"
"Yes, sir. I can do anything I put my mind to," Polly replied haughtily. But she hated the thought that she would have to deal with the black girl on a regular basis. Mr. Derby looked at Polly carefully. His voice was like a sharp stone.
"Don't underestimate me, child. I will not tolerate insubordination. Do I make myself clear?"
What was clear to Polly was that Mr. Derby was used to having his way.
"I'm grateful for the opportunity, sir," Polly said with as much meekness as she could muster. "I will serve you well."
Mr. Derby folded his arms across his chest, then continued.
"Your job is to teach her a little of the King's English, to teach her how civilized people live and act, and, most importantly, to teach her absolute obedience. She belongs to my son, and when he needs her, it is your job to make sure she is delivered to him. Understood?"
"Yes, sir," Polly said quietly.
Clay stood behind his father, chewing on a blade of grass, grinning.
"Both of you are to assist Teenie and not get in her way. I demand perfection, and I expect my servants to be useful and occupied at every moment of the day. In addition, I will not tolerate the questioning of any orders I give, ever."
"Teenie, sir?" Polly asked, a frightened question mark in her voice.
"Do you have a problem with any of this, young lady? Because I can take you right back to where I found you, working for a common scum like Jeremy Cotton as a scullery maid. I have given you a home, a job, and an opportunity to better your life, much more than you deserve. Now get on with you before I change my mind."
Mr. Derby ordered Noah to take the wagon back up to the main house. He motioned to Clay, and the two walked away. Polly breathed a loud sigh of relief as they left. The slave girl did the same, almost at the same moment. They looked at each other tentatively, but neither girl smiled.
Chapter 16. Teeny and Tidbit. Polly entered the shack, not knowing what to expect. The slave girl, who was about the same height as Polly, followed hesitantly behind her. As her eyes adjusted to the dim light, she looked around. It was just one room, barely large enough to turn around in, made of rough wooden planks. It held a small wooden table, a chair, one bed, and a straw mat on the dirt floor. It smelled faintly of sweat.
"I've lived in places much worse," Polly said to the slave girl, who had already sunk to the floor and curled her arms tightly around herself.
She thought back to the damp and moldy shack she'd shared with her mother while her father was in prison, and the attic room at Jeremy Carton's place. The slave girl whispered words that Polly could not decipher.
"You better quit talking that jungle talk," Polly admonished. "I'm pretty sure that would be frowned upon in this place."
She scowled as she looked at the confused expression on the girl's dark face.
"I don't know what Mr. Derby is thinking. How am I supposed to make you civilized?"
Polly looked closely at the slave. Her cheeks were sunken into her thin face, which made her eyes seem very large, like a deer's. When the two girls exchanged glances, Polly could see bitterness flash in the slave's eyes for a moment. Her lips were full, but her nose was tiny, almost like Polly's own. Polly was unaccustomed to being this close to a Negro, and she marveled at how dark and mysterious the girl's face looked. A thin sheen of sweat covered the slave's slim body. Her hair, thick and matted, obviously had not been brushed in a long time. Welts and bruises, some of them quite recent, covered her arms and legs. Polly's stomach suddenly growled, and she pressed her hands against it. When had she last eaten? The slave girl watched Polly carefully, then grabbed her own stomach.
"Well, I suppose you're hungry, too," Polly said. "You have no idea what I'm saying, do you?"
The girl just stared at her.
"This is impossible,"
Polly shouted, and the slave cringed.
"What am I doing out here in a shack taking care of some savage?"
Furious with frustration, she pummeled the lumpy straw mattress with her fists until she was out of breath.
"What am I supposed to do with you?"
The girl shrugged as if she understood. Polly sat down heavily in the wobbly wooden chair and ran her fingers through her own uncombed hair. Her stomach growled again.
"I suppose we must start somewhere," she said with a sigh.
"Hungry," she said, rubbing her own stomach.
"Hungry."
Polly put her fingers to her mouth and moved her lips as if she were eating.
"Hungry.
Eat," she said, not expecting a response. The slave girl looked around cautiously, then, to Polly's utter surprise, said, quite clearly,
"Hungry. Eat."
Polly looked at her suspiciously.
"Either I'm a very good teacher, or you are not as stupid as you look."
"Eat food," Polly said, adding a new word. The slave girl repeated the phrase easily.
"Well," Polly said, with a look of amazement on her face, "I'm just going to talk to you as if you understand, and teach you new words as we get to them. I imagine the sooner I complete this task, the sooner I can be assigned some more respectable duties, like sewing or serving the lady of the house."
The slave girl stared up at her.
From what Mr. Derby told me, this place is called Derbyshire Farms, Polly began. It is a rice plantation. Can you say plantation? Polly repeated the last word slowly. Plantation. Plantation, the girl repeated. Although she certainly hadn't expected this, Polly refused to show the girl any encouragement. I am Polly, and I work for Mr. Derby just like you. She hesitated, then added, Well, not exactly like you. You're a slave, which means you belong to him.
Slave,
the girl said clearly. Her eyes narrowed, and her lips drew back fiercely over her teeth as she said the word. She knows exactly what that word means, Polly thought.
Let's do something easier, like introductions, Polly said, trying to change the subject.
I am Polly, she said, pointing to herself.
Polly. Polly.
Yes, Polly said, allowing herself a smile. And you are Mina. Can you say Mina? It's your new name. She pointed to the girl on the floor.
Mina.
The slave girl shook her head. Amadi, she said with pride, pointing to herself.
I warned you about talking those African words, Polly reminded the girl. You are Mina.
Mina. She said it clearly several times.
No, Mina.
The slave girl frowned and shook her head forcefully.
Amari.
She said it again slowly.
Amari.
Polly sighed and said,
Amari.
Amari smiled at her for the first time.
Amari, she said again.
Well, Amari, the master and his son say your name is Mina, so you better learn that one since it looks as though there's not much chance you'll ever get back to Africa. Just like I'll probably never get back to Buford, she added, almost to herself. Not that I'd want to. The door of the cabin burst open then, and the shortest, skinniest black woman Polly had ever seen pushed her way through the door. She barely came to Polly's shoulder, but she carried herself with the dignity of a giant. Hiding behind her skirts was a very small boy, about 3 or 4 years old, who clung to her leg like an insect.
Well, ain't this the berries? What we got here? She boomed, even though the two girls were sitting right in front of her.
Finally, Polly said timidly,
How do you do? I'm Polly, and this here is Mina.
I knows who you is,
the little woman said with a smile.
I knows everything. Hiding stuff from me is like trying to put socks on a rooster. You want to know the dirt going on round here? Just ask old Teeny, tiny little Teeny.
Then she erupted into a full, hearty laugh that didn't seem possible to Polly, considering how small the woman was.
And this here's my boy, Tidbit.
The child retreated farther behind his mother, but he peeked out to see the new faces.
Pleased to meet you, Miss Teeny, Polly said with difficulty.
She didn't think a Negro deserved the title of Miss, but somehow this woman seemed to require it. Her father had taught her to disrespect Negroes, but her mother had taught her to respect her elders.
Don't be calling me Miss Teeny, lest you want to get us both in trouble, gal. Just Teeny be fine. Y'all hungry?
She asked with a broad grin that showed she had almost no teeth.
Y'all both about as thin as a bat's ear.
Hungry,
Amari whispered.
Well, butter my butt and call me a biscuit. This little African can speak a little English, huh? Don't let him master no gal. Play dumb as long as you can.
With that, she turned and headed out of the door, her child right behind her.
Come on to the kitchen. I'll set you up with some victuals. Lord em me, she said.